We should like to have you meet Mr. Jerry Damon. Mr. Damon is the NBC announcer who hopes to buy Ellis Island. Believe it or not, we think he'll make it.
And they used to kid us all about buying the Brooklyn Bridge.
Well, I want to tell you something. He has all the plans for Ellis Island. He has everything drawn up, everything but the checks to pay for it.
A very ambitious scheme.
Well, as you know, I am in California at the moment, and I must say that I took out a great many presents for my daughter and for my son and for the new baby, and they were bought at G. Fox and Company. Shopping at G. Fox & Company, I think, is always a joy, but right now, with every department bursting with new spring arrivals, shopping really is a wonderful adventure. The spring fashions have all arrived at G. Fox & Company, and you will find the most complete selections in every department. For instance, you might like to choose a suit. Now, for every member of the family, there might be a little one who wants a junior suit. So don't miss G. Fox & Company's wonderful suit collections in the budget suit department, the better suit department, and the specialty shop. Their millinery department, Saluting Hat Week, is a fantasia of fabulous creations. Today is Bettmar Day in particular, with the entire Bettmar hat collection on display. Treat yourself to the fun of early spring shopping at G. Fox & Company and have luncheon this noon at the Hotel Statler Hilton to see the G. Fox fashion show. Make a day of it, won't you, at that great, great store in downtown Hartford. Park conveniently at the G. Fox & Company parking center and shop today between 9:30, when we went on the air, until 6 o'clock. Jerry Damon was really a wonderful experience meeting this charming and brilliant announcer, and I'll tell you why. I looked at Jerry Damon and I said, now this is just a long shot, Jerry, but I remember when my father was professor at City College, one of the other professors who taught Italian, who was professor of Romance languages, used to come to the house. Could it be by any chance that this man was related to you? He was Professor D'Amata, and that was Jerry's father.
No kidding.
Yes, and he was Professor of Italian and Romance languages at City College, and he used to visit our home, and he and my father were great, great friends because my father was professor there, too.
Jerry's a friend of Dick Bertel of our staff.
That's how I met him.
Yeah, they worked in radio together. Mm-hmm. So now Jerry's buying property in New York Harbor.
Boy, and I think he'll make it, you know?
Yeah, good luck.
Good luck, boy. Yeah. Now let's have a New York and New England apple to celebrate this event. Bite into an apple.
I want a crisp air apple that's just come awake.
Yes, a crisp air apple, good to eat or bake.
Imagine an apple this time of the year.
Oh, fresher than September, so I tell you, dear, I want a crisp air apple. Just gotta have it.
Crisp air apple, what a wonderful habit.
A special kind of storage, and you know for fair. The freshest Christmas apples now are called crisp air.
Yes, crisp air apples are here, and right now that means springtime Macintosh apples from local orchards. Tangy, crunchy Macs, picked last fall at the peak of their prime, then rushed to controlled atmosphere storage rooms and put to sleep in perfect condition. Now these fine Macintosh apples are awake and at your market in orchard fresh quality for your springtime enjoyment. So remember,
a special kind of storage, and you know for fair, the freshest Christmas apples now are called crisp air.
I suppose if you bite into anything, you wake it up, don't you?
I imagine so.
Even an apple.
Yep.
Well, now, let's visit with Jerry Damon, and here he is, believe it or not.
I'm here in New York City doing some interviews with very interesting personalities. Our guest is Jerry Damon. Jerry Damon is a well-known announcer with NBC here in New York. But more important, or equally important, is this fact. Mr. Damon, Jerry Damon, is the man who hopes to own Ellis Island. He is trying to buy Ellis Island. Jerry, at long last, you know, I've been more or less chasing you and to do this interview for, oh, I guess months and months and months, and here you are. How are you?
Fine, thank you, and good to see you, Jean.
Well, nice to see you, too. I'm simply fascinated by this idea of yours, purchasing or owning Ellis Island, because I happen to be a New Yorker, and I've heard of Ellis Island my whole life.
Well, of course, Ellis Island is probably the best-known piece of real estate in this country because so many immigrants, 20 million or more, came through Ellis Island, and it's therefore very, very well-known simply as a piece of real estate, more than to just New Yorkers.
I think we should locate Ellis Island, don't you, Jerry?
All right. I can tell you its exact location. It's a mile and a quarter southwest of the southern tip of Manhattan and about a quarter of a mile west of the coast of New Jersey.
Now, is it anywhere near the Statue of Liberty?
Yes, it's about a half a mile north of the Statue of Liberty, and it's 27 and a half acres in size.
Mm-hmm. How did you happen to get the idea of buying Ellis Island? You know, it seems a bit sort of fantastic.
Well, Ellis Island was put up for sale by the United States government through the General Services Administration a few years ago, and it has been put up for sale from time to time with no buyers to the satisfaction of the government. And one of the times that it was put up for sale, we heard of some of the propositions for its ultimate use. I say we, that's Elwood Doubt and I.
Elwood Doubt?
Doubt. No, Elwood Doubt.
Oh, I thought you were talking about Harvey.
No, it's not Harvey's friend. We heard of some of the propositions, as I say, and we felt that they lacked in imagination and lacked in possibilities for what we felt was probably the most unique piece of land in the Western Hemisphere.
Now, should you buy Ellis Island? Now, I don't know how much our government wants for it. I suppose I should ask you that question, too. But suppose you become the owner of this island. What do you propose to do with it?
Well, I'll take one part of the question at a time. Number one, the government hasn't specified a price for the island. I don't believe they will. The second part is the most important part, and that's what we propose to do with it. And this goes back several months to when Frank Lloyd Wright was still living. We felt, at the time that we first attempted to purchase the island, that it would lend itself ideally to the construction of a miniature, ultra-futuristic city. And by saying city, I don't mean housing development or even a fancy housing development. I mean a complete independent entity unto itself.
Would this be anything like Disneyland? I mean, would you use this as a city for entertainment or for people to live on?
Oh, no, this isn't an amusement center. This is an actual city, like any suburb of New York with a population of 7,000 to 9,000 people. It would be a functioning city for people to live on.
Would people get there by ferry? I suppose it would be something like Oakland, California. You'd get there by ferry from San Francisco.
Well, yes, ferry, but the method or type of ferry we propose to use is a completely different method and a rather radical method, one which suits itself, we believe, ideally to transportation to this particular island, and that's the use of high-speed aluminum hydrofoil ferries, which would do the trip in actual traveling time about 75 seconds.
75 seconds on a ferry?
The actual traveling time, yes. They're very fast, very steady.
And what type of a city would this be? You mentioned Frank Lloyd Wright. Would you have ultra-modern houses? Would they be apartment houses, or would they be private dwellings?
They would be apartment houses, and the city would include hotel facilities, some exhibition facilities, a yacht club, houses of worship, schools,
parks,
nightclub, amusement, or rather recreation areas. I'm sorry, I shouldn't have said amusement because it's not an amusement center. So that it will contain all of the functions of a small suburb plus many of the functions that would be found in a small resort town such as Atlantic City or Miami Beach. On that grand scale, of course.
How many people do you think you could house at Ellis Island? I mean, should this, you know, prove to be an absolute fact? I mean, should it come to fruition?
We believe between 7,000 and 9,000 would be its permanent population. That's not including the people that would be working there and performing various of the functions that would be necessary for people just living there.
Now, what is happening on Ellis Island at the present time?
Nothing. There are about 35 or 37 buildings being maintained by the government and watchmen, maintenance workers, but it's not being used for immigration. It hasn't been used for 4 or 5 years or more for immigration purposes.
How do these people get back and forth to Ellis Island?
I believe they use Coast Guard cutters to get back and forth right now, and there's very little traffic to and from the island since there's no immigration there.
Mm-hmm. Well, this would be an ideal place to live, I dare say. It would be certainly beautiful in the summertime and not too cold in the wintertime and really ideal, wouldn't it?
Well, we believe that it would be a most extraordinary place to live for both its architectural design and its position. If you stand on the island and look at Manhattan, you happen to see what is the picture postcard view of Manhattan. It's a very breathtaking view. In addition to which, there's something that we found that was quite exciting about it, and that's the fact that even though Manhattan is within a stone's throw of where you're standing, it seems to be in an absolute quiet of its own. In other words, all you hear if you stand on Ellis Island is the lapping of the water against the seawall around it, and you can look at Manhattan and see it and know that all the roaring and bustling and buses and throbbing populace is there in Manhattan, but you hear none of it. It's a very refreshing thing, very quieting thing.
Ellis, did you mention how much they want for the island? I don't mean Ellis, but I mean Jerry. How much money are they asking for this island?
Well, the government hasn't specified a price. Much of the offers to or solicitations for purchase by various individuals from the government have been by auction or by some form of bidding. And you don't know what the other person is going to offer. Your own offer is simply going to be considered along with his. And, equally importantly, apparently, is the use to which the island will be put. The government is very interested in that. Apparently, they don't want to see something untoward appear in New York Harbor, where approximately 2,000 foreign ships a year come through, where the piece of land is so well known that there might be public disfavor if poor use were to be made of it. So the government is quite interested in what's going to be done.
But about how much? I mean, can you sort of hazard a guess, roughly? I mean, would this be in the millions? I haven't any idea.
Well, all I can say is that some of the bids that have been received by the government range from anywhere from a few dollars from pranksters, maybe, to a million or so in that area.
Now, do people think that you have gone off your rocker because you want to buy this island? I mean, do they take you seriously about this plan?
I don't believe anyone thinks that I've gone off my rocker yet, although the amount of work involved in doing this is so enormous that I may go off my rocker all by myself with no help.
Well, what has been the response? I mean, have you gotten any other partners to go in with you to buy this island?
We've had some excellent response from people who want to back us. And, of course, there are two phases to the financing of it. One is the immediate financing, that of actual purchase of the island. And the long-range financing is that for the actual construction of the city, which we intend to call the Key, by the way.
Mm. Well, evidently Frank Lloyd Wright thought well of it, because he certainly was an astute and brilliant, probably our greatest architect of all times.
I think
if,
so.
If he drew the plans, I knew him and interviewed him, I think he was just a genius.
Well, he had thought for many years about the design of a prototype city. And when we asked him if he would be interested in designing this city for us, he answered quite enthusiastically and went right ahead with the work and laid down all of the basic plans necessary to its completion.
Oh, this long telescope which you have with you,
like
Jerry has a gigantic, as a matter of fact, it looks like an aluminum slender, one of these stovepipes or something you might see on a barge.
It's a map case.
It's a map case.
Yes.
This contains the drawings of Frank Lloyd Wright.
It contains the drawings which are a result of the basic drawings made by Frank Lloyd Wright. In other words, what is in here is a presentation set of drawings done in color and gold leaf and executed for presentation purposes by the Taliesin Associated Architects, which are the Frank Lloyd Wright Foundation architects. Mm. They carried out, for presentation purposes, the conceptual ideas of Frank Lloyd Wright.
Jerry, do you know who originally built Ellis Island? I mean, and why they call it Ellis Island?
Well, Ellis Island was once owned by a man by the name of Sam Ellis. There was an Ellis. And I understand that he lived in New Jersey and used to take his family over there for picnics and a little bit of whatever hunting that he could do there. It was a much smaller island at the time. It was only 3 acres in size. Much of it was a foot or two underwater, which the government, when they bought it from him, shored up and filled in and expanded to its present size. Before Sam Ellis owned the island, it was known as Gibbet's Island because, apparently, the Dutch who were in the harbor and in Manhattan at the time had many very wealthy ships in the harbor, and pirates used to come up and try to trap the Dutch, and the pirates, of course, didn't know their way around the harbor as the Dutch did, and they'd come up the mouth of the river, and the Dutch would stop at a certain point, let some of the ships go all the way up to Spuitendijk, come down the east side, trap them from behind, catch several of the pirates, run them over to Gibbet's Island, and hang them, hence the gibbet. So it's got some pirate history behind it, too, in addition to immigration history.
Of course, the immigration, at one time, they used to house, I mean, thousands and thousands of immigrants there, didn't they?
Yes, and the problem that was involved, apparently, was that many people came over and didn't know whether or not they had proper papers to get into the country through there, and they were kept or detained at Ellis Island for some length of time, and I suppose many of them had to be sent back. Now I understand that the Immigration Service performs all of these functions at the port of debarkation in Europe, let's say, so that if you're permitted to come to the country, you know that before you get on the ship to come over, and I suppose it avoids a lot of heartbreak. Saves a lot of money to the taxpayers, too.
I wonder what the government originally paid Ellis for Ellis Island. Do you know?
I have no idea. I'm sure it isn't anything like what they want for it now.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask you some questions about yourself, Jerry. Where are you from originally?
I'm from Orange, New Jersey.
Mm-hmm. So, of course, Ellis Island is very familiar to you.
Oh, absolutely. As a matter of fact, I'm not sure of this, and I haven't checked it out, but I believe that my father might have come to this country through Ellis Island. Mm-hmm. And one day, when I have a little more time, I'm going to look into that just for a point of curiosity.
How long have you been with NBC as an announcer?
A little over 5.5 years.
You do mostly news, don't you?
Yes, I do. I also announce some TV shows.
But you are, by and large, a news announcer. Do you like doing TV?
Yes, very much. Matter of fact, well, I like all phases of show business. My interest in real estate is not necessarily, I hope, an indication of my lack of interest in broadcasting. Broadcasting is my first love.
Have you ever been an actor?
Yes, I've done quite a... Well, as a matter of fact, I started acting as a boy, as a child, and kept quite an interest in it for a long time, and found that I wanted to earn a more steady living than being an actor can do in its early phases. Hence, staff announcer.
Did you ever do any Broadway shows, Jerry?
Oh, no. I never reached quite that degree of success as an actor. I still do occasional parts in TV or radio shows, but nothing extraordinary, nothing to get excited about.
Now, should you own Ellis Island, should this come to pass, would you give up announcing?
Oh, no. I have no intention of giving up announcing.
Mm-hmm.
This is my profession.
You have a family. You have a wife and two children, don't you? How old
yes,
are the children?
Well, my daughter, Gabby, is 3.5, and my son, Roland, is just 1.
Are you French, Gabrielle?
Her name is Gabrielle. I'm not French. I'm of Italian extraction.
Oh.
But I think we chose the name Gabrielle. Mostly because we like the nickname.
Uh-huh. Well, I thought, you know, when you said Gabby and then Roland, because they're two very French names.
Well, Roland was my father's name.
Oh, mm-hmm. Well, thank you very, very much, Jerry Damon, for being our guest and talking about Ellis Island. Incidentally, should anybody be interested, what do they do? Just call you up at NBC?
Well, I suppose that might be mixing one business with another business. I suppose the simplest thing would be to reach us. I'm in the Manhattan directory, mm-hmm. and we do have a business address, mm-hmm. so that would be...
Well, good luck on this. I did interview a Mr. Robinson some years ago who bought the island of Killarney in Ireland.
Oh, really?
Yes. He only kept it a short time, and then he sold it. But he had marvelous plans of building this island into a beautiful resort, you know, all kinds of hotels. He came from Chicago. Life Magazine ran a story about him. This was about, it was in 1956.
Has anything come of it since?
I don't think so.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. I understand that Life Magazine is interested in doing a story on this, which would be interesting, I suppose, of academic interest to many readers.
Well, again, many, many thanks and good luck.
You know, I was thinking, I don't know, a little while ago we were talking about something to eat, you know, before we listened to the talk with Jerry Damon. About a week ago, I think, I read in the news about the dinner of the Explorers Club. You know that club, don't you?
Yes, I've been there, as a matter of fact.
Oh, brother, what meals they serve. Talk about exotic foods, a squid, and, I don't know, there's all, and these were just hors d'oeuvres. The main course was roast beef.
You know who took me to the Explorers Club? Well, I say you know, but you wouldn't know. Peter Freuchen, when I was a young actress, I worked with him, you know.
I know the name.
He was a great, great explorer. He wrote, you know, The Seven Seas.
Yes.
And, of course, he was a Norwegian, a terrific Scandinavian. Mm-hmm. He could drink 40 cups of coffee.
Could he?
Yes,
he could. They must have all been Nescafe if they were that good.
I hope so.
There once was a dancer who had great routines, but her favorite step she called 43 beans. It was the step that she took to the kitchen each day for a 43 bean cup of Nescafe.
Yes, you get 43 beans in every cup of Nescafe. Real coffee beans, that's all there is in Nescafe. 43 beans in every cup make Nescafe the all-coffee instant coffee. With the let's have another cup taste.
Extra beans means extra flavor. Today's Nescafe goes all the way for flavor with 43 choice beans in every cup. Tastes fresh, friendly, completely satisfying. Right now at your grocer's, there's a special offer on today's Nescafe. Stock up and save while the offer lasts. Make today the day you buy Nescafe.
You know, in listening to the talk with Jerry Damon today reminded me of that story you told about Jerry coming to meet you for the interview. I thought it was rather amusing, and I thought you might tell it to the folks.
I don't think I shall ever, ever forget that day. It was February the 18th, a Thursday morning. The night before, a friend of mine wanted to celebrate my birthday, and I wasn't feeling too well. I guess I was sort of coming down with the grip, you see. We did get to this perfectly beautiful restaurant, Ciro's, in New York City. This was somebody I hadn't seen for about 15 years, I knew him years ago in New York, and I used to visit with him and with his wife. And so he said, "Gene, this calls for a celebration." So we went to Ciro's, and they had champagne ordered and flowers. And when everything came to the table, suddenly I heard myself say, "Bruce, I don't feel well. I think I'm going to faint. Would you take me back to the hotel?" He said, "Gene, is this a joke?" I said, "No, hardly." So I did go back to the hotel. I was violently ill all night long. All I could think of was Jerry Damon, Ellis Island, a recording which I had to do, you see, on a Thursday morning. How could I contact Mr. Damon? Well, I didn't know how to contact him. He came up to the Hotel Chatham at 8 o'clock in the morning. I looked like somebody from the scene, you know, Fall of the House of Usher, because I had very long black hair. My long black hair was trailing, you know, and I had deep circles under my eyes, and I was wearing a quilted robe, and I was freezing. I had the blanket over my shoulder, and he said, "Are you Miss Colbert?" I said, "Yes, Mr. Damon, I'm very ill." He said, "Well, you don't look very well." He said, "Are you sure you're all right? Do you want to do this recording?" And I heard myself say, "Mr. Damon, do you think you could go downstairs and bring up some tea or some coffee, something hot, and if I can keep that down, we'll do the recording." He went downstairs. He said, "Can I leave my telescope here and my maps?" And he went downstairs, came up, and bless him, with the tea and the coffee and some toast. And I said, "Take the toast away." But I got the beverage down, and we did that recording.
Mm.
And he was such a darling. He said, "Are you sure you're all right? Can I put a hot, compress to your head, or would you like some ice cubes on top of your head?" And I said, "Well, I'm okay."
Well,
and, of course, he's Italian, and he's a wonderful person. He made me promise that I would visit with him, and they would fix an Italian supper.
Mm-hmm.
Franco-American spaghetti.
"Let me parler some French to you. Simply to say, la sauce, c'est tout. That means this sauce is everything in Franco-American spaghetti.
vary your Lenten menus with two kinds of Franco-American spaghetti. Franco-American spaghetti with special sauce made from tomatoes and cheddar cheese. And new Franco-American Italian-style spaghetti with a nippy sauce blended from fine Romano, Parmesan, and cheddar cheeses. Both meatless treats from Franco-American.
Let me parlay some French to you. Simply to say, la sauce est tout. That means this sauce is everything in Franco-American spaghetti. La sauce est tout, makes the flavor sing in Franco-American spaghetti.
Well, that winds up our Saturday program. What's on for Monday, Jean?
On Monday, you know, we meet at 2:05. On Monday, our guest will be Roberto Iglesias, bullfighter, Spanish dancer, artist, handsomest Spaniard in the world, the new Jose Greco, the new Jose Limon, only 29 years old, the greatest Spanish dancer of all time. This was the recording which I did at the Bushnell at midnight a few weeks ago when he danced, you know, with his troupe. I saw him dance in Paris, but without a doubt, Roberto Iglesias, this handsome bullfighter dancer, is the greatest dancer of all time. This is Jean Colbert wishing you a pleasant weekend. Meet us on Monday at 2:05. Goodbye.